Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I am, of course, Chris Martinson, and today we are speaking with Joel Salatin, one of the most visible and influential leaders in the organic food and sustainable farming movements. His family owns and manages Polyface Farms, which has been featured prominently in such modern food movement masterworks as The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan, the documentary Food, Inc. If you haven't seen that, that is an incredible eye-opener, was for me. Joel's unconventional but highly innovative farming practices are inspiring millions to increase their nutritional and community resiliency by seeking out local sources of chemical-free food raised using natural process-based farming practices. Joel, I'm a huge fan of your work and the practices you advocate. I apply a number of them in the management of my own small homestead in rural Mass. It's a real honor to be speaking with you.
Thank you. It's an honor to be with you, Chris. Sure.
Well, thanks. Could you please give our listeners a short background on what you see as your mission, what its key tenets are, and why what you're doing is so important?
Sure. Well, our mission statement is to develop environmentally, emotionally, and economically enhanced food prototypes and duplicate their production throughout the world. So it's all about these food production prototypes that not only are economically and environmentally beneficial, but also have a social, you know, we say emotional just so we can have three E's, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's a triple bottom line deal. And wonderfully, if you get creative enough, you don't have to sacrifice the ecology in order to, you know, have a profitable business, and you don't have to sacrifice profit in order to have an ecological business. So the principles are relatively few. You know, it all backs up to biomimicry for sure. In other words, what we want to do is take natural templates, draw a circle around them like a pattern, cut them out, and put them on our commercial farming landscape, and duplicate those, you know, those natural patterns. Well, what are those natural patterns? Well, the things that have regenerated and built soil for centuries are not tillage and annuals, which are, of course, both things that our culture worships. Rather, they're perennials, both trees and forages, and herbivores, and periodic disturbance, whether it's fire, grazing, mob grazing, or you know, other disturbances that are created by, you know, predator-type things, and then rest periods for recuperation and to metabolize the disturbance factor. So as soon as you start doing those kinds of things, it means you're going to move the animals. They're not going to stay in one place. It's going to be primarily perennially based, so we're always looking at how can we harvest acorns from the, you know, trees into pork, for example. It's going to be perennial grasses, not annual grasses or you know, grains. And it's going to be portable infrastructure, not permanent or non-portable infrastructure, which means all of the facilities, the shelters, the control things like fences and things like that are all going to be lightweight, gentle footprinted, portable type things. The fertility is not going to depend on things brought in from across the world. They're going to depend on recycling solar created biomass on site. That's the carbon cycle. Sun makes the plants grow. The plants either get eaten or decay, and the decay feeds the soil life, which makes more plants grow, and that carbon cycle moves in a cyclical pattern on-site, not from off-site. So, you know, there's always a heavy component of animals, perennials, disturbance, rest, portability, and real-time carbon cycling.
And so this, you've been doing it for a while, so you have measurable results that the soil is being built and that you can do this profitably. Is this, I assume, at this point we can say it's a success? You can farm this way and it works?
Oh, unquestionably. Our family came here in 1961, which is 50 years ago, bought the most run-down, gullied, depleted, mined-out farm in the whole area. In fact, you know, we measured the deepest gully was 16 feet deep. Mm-hmm. And we we had so little soil, we could not even hold up electric fence stakes. Dad poured concrete in old used car tires and then pushed a half-inch pipe, one straight up and down and one on a little bit of an angle. And my brother and I, who's a little bit older than I, we'd sit on the platform of the tractor and heave these things off as Dad drove slowly down the field. He'd come along and put electric fence stakes in them because we didn't have enough soil to hold up electric fence stakes. And it doesn't take much soil to hold up electric fence stakes. Mm-hmm. So that's how we started. And we could barely handle, 10 cows. Today, we easily handle 100 cows. All of those bare rock places have, several inches of soil over top of them. And the gullies, we filled a lot of the gullies in with silt that we've dug out of bottoms to build ponds. So we've got ponds built and the gullies filled in, and arguably the most productive farm in the whole area.
And so if this is possible, how many people are following it? And of the people who aren't adhering to these sorts of practices, what's going on there? Why aren't they?
Well, our neighbors think we're bioterrorists because, only a bioterrorist would run chickens out in the field where he can commiserate with red-winged blackbirds and indigo buntings and take our diseases to the science-based Tyson chicken houses and threaten the planet's food supply with disease.
Mm-hmm.
So not only is there not, are people not clamoring to do this, but, we're being demonized by the mainstream agricultural community. And, it's pretty serious. I mean, including the food police, who don't like, small-scale backyard processing or kitchens or anything like that. They want everything to go through a multimillion-dollar facility with chlorine and fumigants and a lot of toxic sanitizers to sterilize everything. And there are major differences of opinion about what proper food is. Now, there's a big difference between sanitation and sterilization. And you and I don't have sterile insides. Our insides have 3 trillion beings to take this food and make it flesh of our flesh and bone of our bone, and we'd better be thinking about what that community wants. And that community is far from sterile. It's a very active bacterial biological community. And so we live in strange days when Coca-Cola, Twinkies, and Cocoa Puffs are considered safe, but raw milk, compost-grown tomatoes, and Aunt Matilda's pickles are considered hazardous substances.
Yeah. So, well, there's a lot to be fighting here. What is the fight center around? Is it just as simple as profits at this point in time, or is it frankly just easier to farm with the other practices? Where do you draw the line on that?
Well, I mean, we can start with the philosophical difference that we think food is fundamentally biological, and most of the culture thinks food is primarily mechanical. And, that's why we can pull DNA structure and genes out of, a pig and put some in a pepper plant and some in a salmon, and have a brand new life form that's a parts-oriented thing, like pieces of an engine. But some of us believe that life is fundamentally biological, not mechanical. The difference being that biological systems can heal. They have resiliency, and they have a reason to be, a reason to exist that demands respect. I call it the pigness of the pig and the cowness of the cow. And when you disrespect that, for example, when the USDA took farmers like me to free dinners for 30 years to teach us the new science-based feeding of cattle with dead cows, we did not do it because we didn't like the USDA or because we were Luddites or not progressive or, mm-hmm. Hated science. We didn't do it because there was no pattern or template in nature in which herbivores eat carrion.
Mm-hmm.
And so, 30 years later, there's this big, collective, oops, maybe we shouldn't ought have done that, And as this mechanical approach toward life has caught up with us with bovine spongiform encephalopathy. And in fact, that's exactly what has created, the E. coli, Campylobacter, Salmonella. All these things are modern mutations and toxic proliferations that have become mainstream with a mechanical view toward, you know, toward life. I mean, we've even got research now going in to try to isolate the porcine stress gene, so we can take that stress gene out of the pig and abuse him a little more aggressively, but at least, you know, he won't be stressed about it. You know, a culture that views its life with that kind of conquistador, mechanical, disrespectful, manipulative mentality will soon view its citizens the same way and other cultures the same way.
So what's the end of that story if man, woman, you know, humans set themselves apart from nature and we do that? When you gaze across the agricultural landscape, what kind of damage are you seeing being done? Is it a one-way cul-de-sac that ends in famine at some point? Or what is it that you see in these practices that ultimately leads you to very, very strongly eschew them?
Yeah, well, what we're seeing is exactly what we're seeing right now. We're seeing, you know, childhood leukemia. We're seeing gluten intolerance. I mean, how many people did you know 30 years ago that were intolerant to gluten and wheat? And part of that's because, you know, we've streamlined the harvesting so fast industrially that the wheat never gets shocked and never gets any mold in it to break down some of these enzymes that are real hard for our bodies to break down. And so, and you're seeing, of course, type 2 diabetes, you're seeing obesity, and we're just seeing a proliferation of these chronic type things that are a result of bushels of material that is not nutrient dense or nutritionally based, and it certainly isn't food that we have been used to eating. I mean, our bodies, that 3 trillion member community in our insides, you know, is not meant to receive substances, you know, that you can't pronounce or you can't make in your kitchen or that were grown with artificials. Sir Albert Howard said in 1943 in his foundational work, An Agricultural Testament, that when we use artificial manures, that's what he called chemical fertilizers, artificial manures for the soil, then they grow artificial plants, which then make artificial animals, which then make artificial humans, which require artificials in order to keep us alive. And if that isn't a commentary on where we are today with the drug trade and the pharmaceutical industry, I don't know what is. You know, in the last 35 years, our culture has exchanged an 18% per capita expenditure on food and 9% on health care to 18% on health care and 9% on food. And I would suggest that it doesn't take a rocket scientist to think that there might be a connection between the inversion of those two numbers.
Well, I mean, it's certainly anybody who's seen the obesity maps that I think the NIH has put out, they're really quite impressive, stretching from the 50s to current, and just watching the obesity epidemic spread across. Clearly, that has to be due to something. We might think food. And one of the areas I've been focused on for a while, because I'm very focused on the energy sphere and wondering how energy feeds into everything, and of course, it feeds into our food system enormously. And one area is in nutrient cycling. So if we have our typical NPK, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, you know, those things are mined somewhere or manufactured and trucked and put in a field, and then something's grown and harvested and put on a plate, and then it gets flushed out to sea, never to be seen again, you know, in usable quantities.
Right.
So this whole idea of nutrient cycling, but those are just the big ones. There's micronutrients as well that are incredibly important. How does your approach incorporate and deal with the nutrient cycling?
Well, that's a great question. Well, what stimulates the nutrient cycling is the on-site biomass regeneration cycle, not the least of which, of course, is the earthworm community. You know, it's amazing that earthworms can eat a pound of stuff in their front end and send it through their alimentary canal, bring it out their back end, the same pound of stuff, and it's like 3 times the calcium, 7 times the nitrogen, 11 times the potassium, 14 times the phosphorus, plus, you know, an elevating of all the whole trace elements, boron, cobalt, you know, copper, molybdenum, all those things are increased. And what's amazing is nobody knows how that's done. It's actually not concentrated. It's actually, you know, acted on by, you know, by some sort of a activity in the earthworm. Azotobacter bacteria, for example, are free living. They're not rhizomes on like legume roots like alfalfa and clover. They're free living bacteria that will bring up to 100 pounds of nitrogen per acre per year out of the atmosphere and put it in the soil, but they only really become active at 4% organic matter. And, you know, most of our soils are not anywhere close to 4% organic matter anymore. You know, they used to be back when the buffalo were here and these perennial grasses, but they're not now. I think it's fascinating that we actually produced more nutrient density in what is now the U.S. 600 years ago than we actually do today, even with all of our, you know, with all of our petroleum and everything. So the whole secret of the nutrient cycling is to tap in to the green material, to capture more solar energy, put it into green material that can decompose and go into the soil. And the best way to do that is with an herbivore, lamb, goat, cow, some sort of herbivore that is what I call the biomass accumulation restart button to make that to prune that forage off and restart the fast biomass accumulation cycle. If you don't have that, what you just have is the biomass just goes into senescence, and in senescence, simply vaporizes the CO2 off into the atmosphere, and it doesn't do anything any good. So it's the animal that recycles, that starts that whole fast metabolism cycle to metabolize the solar energy into biomass through photosynthetic activity.
I think you're talking about something really radical here, which is that our own health is linked to and part and parcel of the health of the world in which we live. I mean, it's crazy talk right there, don't you think?
Yes, but that is the only way to actually have a regenerative, sustainable system. You know, our culture is a kind of product of the Greco-Roman Western linear reductionist compartmentalized fragmented, systematized, parts-oriented thinking in which nothing relates to anything else. And so we study things, we study things by tearing them apart and not seeing how they fit into a whole. And of course, life isn't like that. And, you know, you can't extract your living from the hydrology cycle, from the energy cycle, from the biomass regeneration cycle. Ultimately, you know, what I always tell people is to realize, it's a profound thought, that everything that we see is completely and utterly dependent on an unseen world of beings in the soil that never make it to the page of a business plan or a bank statement. Nobody asks about this trillion and multiplied trillions and trillions of organisms that live in the soil, and yet every one of us is utterly and completely dependent on that world. And yet we don't even put it in the business plan as an important part of what we're doing. We don't think about it in the shower in the morning when we get ready to go to work. Let's see, how's my activities today going to impact this soil web, this miraculous, mystical, awesome, unseen world that runs all the plants, all the animals, all the water cycle, all the nutrient cycling. You know, what are my activities today going to do to that? You know, we don't even think about that in the shower in the morning.
Right. Well, you know, we've got the UN projecting through their Population Study Center. They've got a branch that's projected that by 2050 we're going to have to basically double food output across the globe. You know, obviously our oceans are pretty well tapped out, and it turns out that a lot of the gains, the productivity gains that we experienced in the so-called Green Revolution, yeah, there was some neat variety tinkering and genetics and stuff in there, but mostly that was irrigation and the application of the artificial fertilizers and all of that. How do we, in your mind, can the type of farming practices you're talking about can those be the gateway that will allow us to actually increase our food production to levels that are being talked about? Or is even that just silly talk at this point in time? We're going to have to find some other way to adjust here.
Oh, there's no question, absolutely no question, that these systems are far more, far more productive. Just let me give you an example. On our farm in our county, one of the measures for pasture production is in cow days per acre. In other words, a cow day is what one cow will eat in a single day. That's one cow day. And so in our county, the average cow days per acre is currently 80 cow days per acre. That's what an acre of pasture does. On our farm, and I already told you at the top of the program what our farm looked like 50 years ago, without a single chemical fertilizer and without planting a seed, we own no plow and no disc in 50 years. We have moved this farm to average 400 cow days per acre. Wow. That's five times the county average. And so, the fact is that if Monsanto figured out a way to get 1% increase in yields in something, it would make the front page of the New York Times. I'm telling you ways to double and triple production without chemical fertilizer, without even planting anything. And it doesn't even make the front. It doesn't even make the obituary page. So yes, these systems work, and the way they work is to go back to historically, the way nature built soils in the first place, which was with primarily herbivores. So if you really want to eat, on a low energy system, quit eating chicken, and quit eating so much pork, and eat grass finished beef. Because grass-finished herbivore is the most nutrient-dense substance that doesn't require any tillage. It fertilizes itself and doesn't require any tillage. As soon as you take that herbivore and put it in a feedlot on an irrigated, grain-based system, then it all breaks down from an energy standpoint. And, of course, that's where a lot of the studies that impugn livestock come from.
Mm-hmm.
But, throughout the world, the great prairies and the great soil-building regions of the world, from the Serengeti in Africa to the plains of America with buffalo, to the to the Australian continent 200 years ago that had 10 marsupial species to do the disturbance. All of those were built with herbivores, disturbances, and rest and perennials. Those are the four cornerstones of a system that works. The reason all civilizations throughout history have been built around the herbivore, lamb, goat, or cow, is because the herbivore is the only domestic animal that can harvest non-tilled, non-planted material. Omnivores like chickens and pigs require some sort of a grain component, which then requires tillage. And until cheap energy and cheap machinery, tillage was extremely expensive. If you had to go out and walk all day with a sharp stick behind an ox or a yak or a mule, you couldn't stir very much soil. You had to plant by throwing it out with your hand. Then you had to hand weed. Then you had to hand scythe, shock it up, and then bring it into a hard floor where you could beat it to winnow out the to separate the grain from the husk. Then you had to take a crude wooden pitchfork and fling it up in the air in a breeze flailing was the first one. This is winnowing, to winnow out the chaff. And at the end of the day, you look on the ground and, oh, we've got some grain here, and now we're going to try to store it in something away from the mice and the rats for a year before the time of sheet metal and mesh wire. Historically, grain was extremely expensive and hard come by, which is why poultry was only eaten by kings, and poultry and pigs were only grown enough to salvage the waste stream from the homestead. The main thing was lamb, goat, and cow, which is the herbivore. That was the main thing, and or deer or bison or whatever. But the point is that those herbivorous creatures are made to do very well without any tillage whatsoever. And tillage has only been actually doable on a large, grand scale just in the last century.
I'm glad you mentioned the energy portion of the cycle. At ChrisMartinson.com, we spend a lot of time on energy. We look at the food supply as being critically vulnerable to the impact of peak oil's arrival. After all, fossil fuel energy inputs vastly exceed the caloric output of most so-called modern farms. So our view is, we cannot really increasingly use a limited resource forever. Our view is that most people alive today will experience a decline of oil firsthand, not meaning it runs out, but we have slightly less and less. And it's a huge, huge implication behind that. And we also focus on helping people develop personal resiliency, starting with food, storing food, finding local suppliers, even growing at least a small percentage of their calories so they can be connected to the food supply more personally. What guidance are you offering to people, to our listeners, in terms of how they should be or might begin to think about interacting with their food supply?
Oh, that's such a great quest. It's a broad span. I would say number one, find your kitchen. I mean, processed food is heavily packaged. Packaging is extremely expensive. It's essentially stored for a long time, and it has a long distribution cycle. I mean, 1,500 miles per morsel is kind of the average. And so my first advice to anybody is buy unprocessed raw and fix it in your kitchen. That'll drop the energy footprint way, way, way down. And as soon as we do that, then, of course, the next step is to either grow some or buy it locally. There are thousands of high-quality, nutrient-dense, ecologically encouraging farms that are selling, from farmers markets to community-supported agriculture to on-farm stands to metropolitan buying clubs to, retail boutiques, whatever, but there are plenty of these kinds of things. Buying organic from 1,000 miles away doesn't get the job done. Mm-hmm. It's just as energy intensive as anything else. And so that's part of this whole local this local food awareness. Now, can a locality feed itself? Absolutely. Think about the amount of food or the kinds of food that could be grown within 100 miles of you. And just think about, going down to the supermarket, walk through the aisles, and say, how much of this could be grown within 100 miles? In northern climes, if we take off, citrus and coffee and tea, and sugar, it can almost all be grown there. So it's arguable. I think this is a fascinating thing. It's really arguable right now whether a culture which has incarcerated twice as many people in prison as it has farmers growing its food, whether a culture that disconnected from its ecological umbilical can even survive. So I think here again, we have to approach this from an integrated, holistic standpoint. The common temptation is for you and I to say, You got to do something. You got to do something different. You need to do this and that and the other. And we fail to realize that we are part of the issue. And none of the situation we've gotten ourselves into is a result of any one person's doing. It's a collective accumulation of societal, a new societal protocol, which I would suggest is very historically abnormal. So first of all, find your kitchen. Then source your food locally, and then grow some yourself. I mean, we've got, for example, to just show how disintegrated our thinking is, we've got now, for example, in New England, we've got confinement dairies who 20 years ago got environmental awards for taking taxpayer money to put in manure lagoons as a manure management program. Now they're getting taxpayer-sponsored money to get to cover those lagoons with rubber bladders to capture the methane. So they and getting little greenie and environmental awards for being green, capturing methane, so they can run all of the expensive fans and machinery and buildings and equipment that's necessary in a confinement dairy operation. Hmm. What we need to be doing is shutting down the confinement dairy operation, turning the herbivores back out on the perennials like they were meant to be, letting them self-harvest, self-fertilize, and shut down the entire concentrated animal feeding operation with all of its intended energy requirements. Same thing goes, for example, for restaurants or let's take a college that figures out, let's take all of our kitchen scraps and send them up the road 10 miles to the composting outfit, and then the dining services coordinator gets a nice plaque and a little award for being green because now they're composting their kitchen scraps. What we need to be doing is building a little chicken house adjoining the back door of the kitchen, so all the kitchen scraps can go right out into the chickens. The chickens then can eat that, produce eggs. Now we don't have to grow any grain, till the grain. Chickens resume their historically normal cycle, which was the homestead salvage operation, to take all the kitchen scraps and whey scraps and cheese scraps and all that and convert it into eggs. Now we don't even have to have concentrated animal feeding operations for chickens anymore, and the Humane Society can rejoice in that we don't have to have any battery egg production. You don't have to truck those eggs into the city, into the college, and the eggs go right into the dining services, and the kitchen scraps go out, and it's a beautiful, beautiful circle. That is the kind of integration. You know, we talk about windmills and getting energy and stuff. My goodness, if we would take on every southern exposure of every house and office building and school and whatever, if we would just take wire mesh or cattle panels and just tip up a frame and cover it with plastic to make a simple solarium 8 feet out from the southern side of every building, we could virtually heat all the buildings without any energy and grow our mescaline mix and shut down all the trucks bringing California produce to New England over the winter time, if all the diesel fuel being put through refrigerated trucks to bring unseasonable produce to New England and Virginia, I call it the northern tier, if all that diesel fuel were converted into plastic to make hoop houses, season extensions, and solariums on the south side of buildings, we wouldn't have to run any of those trucks. We wouldn't have to build any of those roads. We wouldn't have to use any of that energy to do that. And that becomes, that's an integrated, holistic approach rather than some sort of I'm going to continue to eat my California-introduced mescaline mix in February in New York City, hang the system, and let's have some more, figure out how to make some more cheap fuel.
Sure. So we're talking about just thinking about the issues before us and maybe trying to find clever ways around it. I'm personally shocked and sometimes dismayed at how far we still seem to need to go. For instance, in my local area in Greenfield, Mass, are proposing a biomass plant. It sounds all green and everything, right? But it's going to require 500,000 or 600,000 tons of forest to be cut down, trucked to the central location. And they're building it with the intent that they need to do something with the waste heat, so there's all this piping they're going to have to put in. Anybody who treats heat as a waste stream at this point in time, I don't think really deserves any green plaques, hasn't really thought it through, and doesn't understand much about what they're trying to solve.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Yes, yes. Now, to be sure, I am certainly a friend of biomass, and I mean, I'm not interested in cutting down all the forests, but we could certainly, it is a very, very renewable resource. In fact, in Austria, I'm told that virtually all of the urban homes are heated by pellets, wood pellets. So like here in the U.S. where we have the propane or fuel oil truck that goes along and fills people's, fuel oil tanks and propane tanks, the same kind of truck goes along with a little auger in it and stops at your basement window and augers your bin full of wood pellets, and it goes on down the street to the next house. So, I absolutely think that you know, biomass certainly has a role to play, and I think that we have created some real problems by not cutting crooked and diseased trees and things like that. Our national forests are in a deplorable shape. Our parks are you know, Yellowstone fires were caused because of a no-cut policy. Well, instead of having a no-cut policy, let's strategically cut and apply good silvicultural practices, and there's enough wood out there to supply everything. Anytime a Scandinavian comes here for a visit, they just go into apoplectic seizures about how terribly inefficient Americans are with their, you know, with their forests. And I couldn't agree more. We've got a buildup of waste of, you know, junk wood oxidizing on the forest floor, and that certainly needs to be used, and we need to cull, and we need to weed our forests just like anything else. But yeah, unfortunately, many of these things are, again, they're so industrial scaled and so sized that they're not community appropriate. When I think of energy, I think of community scaled. The thing is, in a given community, you know, there might be a creek with a lot of fall in it. Well, whoever's on that creek can put in a little, you know, Pelton wheel and run a hydro project. Maybe somebody else, like us, for example, we have hundreds of acres of really high-quality, well-growing trees on our farm forest. Well, they need to be culled and thinned and that sort of thing. Well, maybe we could have a little steam engine. And another neighbor with some real good bottom land, maybe he wants to grow some corn and run an alcohol, electric generation thing. Maybe somebody else sits on a hilltop and has wind, so he puts up a wind generator. The point I'm making is that when all of us plug into the grid with our little what we can offer, suddenly the community has power, but it's completely decentralized. It's autonomous to the community. All the facilities are at a scale that nest into the ecological womb of the village. That, I think, makes sense.
It does. It makes a lot of sense. I think we'll get there, is my view. But I think it's going to require maybe a bit of a crisis first for some reason. We seem to be unable to get there on our own terms, so we'll get there by some other terms at some point. It's kind of how I'm looking at this point.
Yeah, well, disturbance is always the precursor to innovation. You never really have innovation until you have a level of disturbance, and certainly, you know, expensive fuel is becoming a societal disturbance right now.
Mm-hmm.
And if we would quit trying to, you know, build empires around the world that would love us enough to continue our flow of oil and keep all that money at home and let the fuel go to wherever it needs to be, it would create a little more disturbance, and we'd maybe become a lot more clever about what we're doing. And I think it's actually, my mechanic, and I'm sure you've heard of this, and I've collected these kind of clippings for my lifetime, says that even in the late 1960s, there was plenty of technology to build 100 mile per gallon carburetors. But the auto companies kept, you know, buying up these backyard entrepreneur innovators, you know, their patents and their products, and these things never saw the market. And I think it's unconscionable that we would have buried technology that would have allowed us to quadruple our miles per gallon for that long. I mean, I think it's obscene.
Well, there's a lot to be said for these disruptions you're talking about. It's our view that perhaps some are coming up. Joel, I understand you have a book coming out this fall. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. The title is Folks, This Ain't Normal. And it actually contains some of the things that I've just been talking about. When we talk about historical normalcy, high fuel prices and the herbivore, the biomass cycle, all those kinds of things. This whole century of cheap fuel, indiscriminate antibiotic use, the mechanics that went along with it, you know, unpronounceable food, and, you know, no chores for children. Mm-hmm. You know, these are amazing times, including the whole, you know, the whole food police thing, where you and I can't just decide to eat what we want to eat. You know, these are all unprecedented trials in the history of civilization. And, you know, I think anybody under 50 today just can't even fathom a time when there were no TV dinners, no supermarkets, when we actually ate seasonally, when 50% of all the vegetables were produced in backyard gardens, when homes actually still had functional larders. And we don't even use the term larder today, you know. Anyway, what we view today as normal, I argue, is simply not normal. And the fact is that if you wanted to go to town 100 years ago, you wanted to, or, you know, 120 years ago, if you wanted to go to town, you actually had to go out and hook up a horse in order to go. Now, that horse had to eat something, which means you had to have a patch of grass somewhere to feed that horse, which means you had to take care of some perennial in order to feed that horse in order to go to town. And so you had, throughout history, you had these kind of what I call inherent boundaries or breaks on how much a single human could abuse the ecology. And today, during this period of cheap energy, we've been able to extricate ourselves from that entire umbilical, if you will, and just run, you know, willy-nilly, as if there is no constraint or restraint. And now we're starting to see some of those, you know, some of the, you know, the outcomes of that boundless, of that untied progression. And so the chances are, the way to bet is that in the future, we're going to see more food localization. We're going to see more energy localization. We're going to see more personal responsibility in ecological lifestyle decisions, because it's going to be forced on us to survive economically. We're going to have to start taking some accounting of these ecological principles, and so those are kind of the themes and the arguments that I put in the book. There's a lot of satire, a lot of humor, and the title is "Folks, This Ain't Normal."
Great title. I get a lot from the title alone. So if we were to summarize here, we've got basically a lot of unsustainable practices that just energetically don't make sense, maybe ecologically don't make sense from a sustainability standpoint. Obviously, we'd love to be sustainable in this world, because I'd like to think that in 1,000 years there'll still be people here doing wonderful things. And at the same time, we note that disruptions are the way things change. And so anything that's unsustainable, the definition is it'll someday stop. Certainly there are warning signs abundantly strewn about the landscape for anybody who cares to look. A lot of people are. That's the good news. And the other good news that I get from your message is that integrated approaches and integrated understandings of how these pieces fit together are well within our grasp. In fact, there are working practices out there, your farm being an example, or set of nested examples. And so this is all something that it's not beyond us. We can do this, but we're just going to have to understand, I think, start with the understanding that where we're living today is, folks, it ain't normal.
Well said. Well said. Couldn't agree more.
Well, all right. Well, Joel, it's been a real pleasure talking to you, and I want to thank you for this opportunity and wish you all the best.
Thank you, Chris. It's been an honor to be with you. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.